Looking back through the files of the Bunyip for Wednesday, June 19, 2024, down in the basement of the Gawler Civic Centre. Basement sounds very, like, dingy, but it isn't. It's gorgeous here. Love it.
Bright and warm. And
very surrounded by books and historical stuff and lovely people.
Yes.
My name is Kay and I'm one of your readers along with Jeanette. Hello, Jeanette.
Hi, Kay.
And in the background we have Les and Jill working as volunteers, as they do every week. I'll kick off with 150 years ago, our town clock. An ancient writer of sacred character asks the question, if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself for the battle? And by parity of reasoning, we ask, if the Gawler town clock does not keep right time, how can Gawler people keep it? A query arising out of several complaints that have reached us as to the erratic character of our town timepiece, which perhaps the inspector of nuisances will see to. And yes, that is one sentence. The clock has, we believe, been recently new cased, but this does not appear to have had much difference in the case. So, the poor old clock, is it still working there?
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
It's still maintained.
But of course, back then, a clock was vital for everybody in the town to set their watches by.
Absolutely.
Because they didn't have GPS, they didn't have mobile phones or computers.
And
at
very
home.
Few had, they might have had pocket watches if they were lucky.
If they were wealthy, but a lot didn't. A lot of working people, that would have been their timepiece.
Absolutely.
That they relied on. And even those that had pocket watches would have set their watches quite often by the town clock.
Yeah.
So it was actually really, really,
really
important,
important
for the clock to tell the time.
Wow. I like the inspector of nuisances.
Yes, yes.
Well, anyway, if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself for the battle? Okay. Right, I'll think about that. Must be a biblical reference.
Sounds like it, yes. So, on to 100 years ago, the story of the weeks. The calendar is increasingly at the mercy of the people who get up big stunts. We have just emerged successfully with a headache from Education Week, and now we are up against Wine Week. It is not so long since we had Commerce Week. Some of the churches have added Father's Day to Mother's Day. What about a day for aunties and uncles, when all the old bachelors and old maids could have a look in? The program of the viticulturalists is neither so ambitious nor so long as that of the educationalists, so that we may thank our stars things are not worse and look forward and wonder wistfully what is coming next. Hospital Week, I suppose.
Oh, that's straight out of the mouths of Sit, I think.
Teetotalers Week.
Okay. Oh.
Imagine the teetotalers
well, we
would
have
been unhappy.
We have days now, don't we?
Yes,
like today
we have
is
days.
Harmony Day. I know that because we had a citizenship ceremony this morning. And,
right.
And I was told I'll wear orange, which I completely forgot. So anyway.
We still have Book Week.
Book Week. And then, of course, we have History Month.
Yes.
And all sorts of stuff.
I'm sure the Brosser would love to have Wine Week reinstated.
I think not just the Brosser, it'd be a lot of people that might enjoy that. So 100 years. All right, over to 50 years. Councillor 43 years. Mr E.H. Reinfeldt has retired after serving as a councillor on the District Council of Muddlawira for 43 years. Following last week's council meeting, councillors, their wives and the full staff met at the chambers for tea to farewell Mr Reinfeldt. He represented Ashwell Ward for the whole of his 43-year term, including some years as council chairman. A number of speakers paid tribute to Mr Reinfeld, including the chairman, Councillor D. McN. Fife. Councillor Fife spoke of Mr Reinfeld's record-breaking term, during which he had been active and had shown an attitude was right up to date with modern trends. A couple of comments there. The councillors, their wives and full staff, so there were no female councillors. And what was the other thing?
There was the odd female councillor in South Australia at that time.
Yeah, but not 50 years ago. Yeah, yes, there were, but it was really, it's still a reasonably rare thing.
I did Google the first female councillor in South Australia, but I don't remember now. That was a long time.
No. So anyway, you had something to add. You've done a little bit of research, Jeanette. So
I did, into Muddlawira, because, of course, I've got an interest anyway in Muddlawira South Council.
Yep.
So Muddlawira, which is sort of Adelaide Plains area, it was established in 1854 as Mudlawirra Council, and then in 1867 it divided into Mudlawirra North and Mudlawirra South, which that covered Kangaroo Flat and most of Williston was part of Mudlawirra South.
Yep.
So almost, I think it went to the river. Incorporated part of what is now Gawler.
Yep.
And so then it reformed to become Mudlawirra again in 1933. It became Mudlawirra. And that was amalgamated with Freeling to form Light Council.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit surprised that it was still extant 50 years ago, because I thought, that's why I looked it up, because I thought Mudlawirra had ceased to exist as a council.
No, well, I remember Lance Hatcher was the CEO, one of the district clerk of Mudlawirra, and, I mean, that's within my memory, which
it must have been about 70s.
I think the 70s, there were a whole heap of, about 74 there were some amalgamations and changes, but Mullala Council, where I live, that didn't change until, well, we haven't changed boundaries since 1935.
Right.
So we're still the same as we were then. Lots of talk about, you know, we should split it up, but of course, what do you cut it up to? You just put a bit with Wakefield Plains and we'll get forgotten. You put a bit with Palayford, we get forgotten. You put a bit with Light Regional, you get forgotten. So it's in our best interest to stay as we are.
Yes. Yeah.
We have, believe me, we've discussed it. full disclosure here, I'm also an elected member of Adelaide Plains Council. Mm-hmm. So, yes, anyway, amongst other things.
So, 25 years ago, class win for Andy. Andy Hayden won his class and finished second outright for bikes in the Fink Desert Race near Alice Springs over the recent Queen's Birthday long weekend. Australia's longest, hardest, fastest and richest desert race attracted record fields of cars, bikes, 210 and buggies, chasing a prize pool of $57,000 plus trophies. Andy's teammate Jason Dunstall finished second in class and seventh outright for bikes. Last year, Andy was fifth outright bike, following a fall on the last leg of the grueling two-day race.
He was a good rider.
Mmm.
Good rider. Oh, so. What was he? He's
still is.
Still alive.
Yeah.
I don't think he rides much anymore.
It's very much a young person sport, and 25 years ago, I guess he's not so young now.
10 years ago, motels open doors. After nearly a year, Gawler's only motel is back up and running under new ownership. Known as Prasad's Gawler Motel, the business reopened its doors last week, but the premises is still expected to undergo major changes. Around 40 of the 104 rooms will be reopened for public hire, while a portion of the motel will be made available for crisis care. The motel closed down last July following the death of its owner, Mr. Umanand Prasad. Gawler business owner Jim Vallelonga, who has been working on the redevelopment, said the property had been purchased by a handful of investors who formed Prasad's Motel Proprietary Limited. Mr. Vallelonga said the premises will also be renamed Gawler Motel. Okay, so it's still operating?
I think that they do crisis care still.
I didn't realise that. I haven't heard much about it. I know we used to hear a bit about it when it was run by Dr. Prasad. There were concerns about the condition, the way it was sort of kept and the way it was maintained.
Mum stayed there one night. She wasn't too impressed with it.
Yeah, it was. I heard stories that it was dirty, but you know, skip it.
It was coming over, and we just had our floors sanded. And we thought, she can stay in the front room, but it wasn't possible. So we had to put her up for the night at present, because really, was nowhere else.
Really in Gawler. I mean, we've got all these pubs that you would think could offer accommodation up on the upper levels.
Yes, of course, originally hotels in Australia had to offer accommodation.
Yes.
That's how they got their licence, and that's why they all have that upstairs. Yeah. And you can see, like in their PA, how they were rooms up there once.
So. Yeah. Anyway, look, that...
We were going to get Jill to
talk. Oh, Jill. Yes,
so we have
Jill,
a
we're going
bit of extra
to...
information about one of the stories from last week's look.
So...
The one about the Evanston Primary School fire.
Yes.
So Jill's friend was the relevant teacher of that classroom that burned. So Jill is going to give us a little bit of background.
Okay. So, yes, the fire at Evanston Primary School in last week's Bunyip was actually the fire of the classroom of one of my close friends, Heather Mitchell, and she had been a teacher for a very long time. So when the fire occurred, it was devastating for her and for the children. she lost all her teaching equipment that she'd accumulated over many, many years of teaching. The children lost all their schoolwork and all their artwork and all those sort of things. That all went as well. And it was very traumatising for not only the teachers but the children in particular to arrive at the school and see a smoking ruin. But they were really good. At the time, the education department had this policy that if there's any fires in the school, the children are to be kept away and then it has to be, like, demolished basically overnight.
Wow.
So that when the children came into the school the next day, there was nothing there. It was just an empty space. And I can remember it being in the Bunyip. I can remember it happening. But I also personally hearing it from my friend Heather, who still, even to this day, is quite distressed when she talks about it. Those classrooms were wooden classrooms. They were the old wooden transportables. I actually taught in... I had classes in that previously in years gone by. And when I was in that classroom, the thing that happened to it was that the termites ate right through the entire wall.
Oh!
And we had a shelf with brand new atlases all piled on top of one another. And I picked one up to give it to the children, and I saw this huge hole that went all the way down all the atlases.
Oh,
They'd burrowed their way right through. And there was just the one at the top that wasn't, so you didn't know it was there. And then you took it off and there's a huge hole. Oh. And that was the same classroom. And I was outside one day, the same classroom, and I leant against the wall and my hand went through the wall because the termites had eaten all the wood and left the paint there.
Yeah.
So that was... Yeah, that was really funny at the time, but the fire itself, when this was sort of much later, I wasn't at the school at the time, and yes, it was awful for the children, but they were so quick in dealing with that and getting rid of it so that it, psychologically it was better for the children to do it like that. Than see a smoking ruin.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember those old classrooms. You used to open the hopper door on the side, which was a fire escape, I think, but they used to open the door so in summer to get the cool air to come in. And
it had louvered doors on, louvered windows on one side of a corridor, and then it had sash windows that went up, and so you could open the sash windows and the louvers and you'd get a cross breeze through there, plus we could open the fire escape. I was actually the same classroom. Kevin Shear was the principal at the time and I was in that room. It originally did not have a fire escape, and they realised, the education department realised, that all these transportables that were in all the schools didn't have official fire escapes.
I don't remember any fire escapes in the school.
Yeah, so they actually had to come along and make those fire escapes that dropped down.
I remember mine from, I was at primary school, we didn't have a high school, so primary school in the 60s, we had them. But the other thing that they had to be aware of was the drop from that fire escape onto the ground. And their, were all built with the, you know, you had a little corridor with all your bags and seats facing north and, and the glass. And then facing south was the hoppers, so that's why we'd get cool air in. And that was also the lower point because they're on the side of a hill.
There were good things and bad things about those classrooms. The bad thing being that they burnt down very easily.
Yes, they did.
Asbestos in them?
I don't know. They were mainly wood.
Okay, so maybe they were pre-asbestos.
Yes, but they were great in that when the cool change arrived, say late in the day or something like that, the classrooms, because they were wood, there was no insulation or anything like that. But they cooled down really quickly, whereas the rest of the school was stone built and pebble dashed. And it took a lot, the heat inside those rooms took a really long time to dissipate. So although there were lots of things about those transportables that were awful, and we were forced to work in pretty horrible conditions, and we tried to make the best of it for the children, but at least they cooled down when the cool breeze came in. You get there in early in the morning, and it was, they were lovely and cool, where the rest of the school was really still hot. Okay, so that's all about that famous classroom.
Yes.
And I'm just signing off on behalf of Jill. Thank you, Jill. Jeanette and myself, Kay, and we'll be back online next week, all being well.
Till next
week.
Bye
for now.
Bye. For all
mine.